Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Thinking Christianly podcast, sponsored by Global Scholars. I'm your host, Jordan Plank. Joining me are Dr. Stan Wallace and Dr. J.P. Moreland.
We have been talking in the past two episodes about freedom and the two predominant ideas that seem to come up pretty often. Last time we talked about how these ideas apply to theology. This time, we are talking a bit more about how these ideas play out in other areas. Stan and JP, I'm going to open it up to you. How do you see the ideas of libertarian free will and compatibilism play out in fields beyond theology?
Well, I think a good first place to start is with the whole idea of crime and punishment. Retributive justice, putting someone in prison. Now, there have been a number of studies, I've seen a couple of those, that indicate that the common sense view of people is clearly the libertarian view of freedom. And basically, that means that if I act freely, there is absolutely nothing that's outside my control that determined that I do that. If I act, I have to be able to do the act, raise my hand and vote, or refrain from raising my hand to vote. And at that very moment when I act, the choice is completely up to me. So to be free is inconsistent with being determined. The compatibilist says that freedom is compatible with being completely determined. And so on this view, there's a change in what it means to be free. To be free is not to have the power to choose or refrain from choosing at the moment of choice with nothing determining me. Rather, freedom is the ability to do what you want to do or desire to do, but your desires and wants are completely determined by things that predate your birth and that are completely outside your control. All right. So now, when you think about the criminal justice system and finding someone, quote unquote, guilty for doing something, there are four basic reasons for putting someone in prison. The first one is retributive justice, that the moral law, the moral universe, if you want, or God, there's an imbalance because there has been an evil done, and that needs to be paid for to balance that out. So there needs to be an appropriate punishment for the thing that was done wrong. Then the next one is to rehabilitate the individual by getting them in prison and give them some job training. The third would be it protects people in society by getting this person off the street so that they won't hurt more people. And then finally, it actually serves as a deterrent to other people thinking about doing similar crimes because it sends the message that the police are efficient and they catch who does this and put them in prison. Now, the only one of those that looks backwards in time at the criminal act itself is the first one, retributive justice. All the other three are utilitarian. They look to the future, and they say that it'll produce the best consequences for the greatest number of people if we rehabilitate this person, if we deter other criminals by being efficient, and if we get them off the street. So if you hold to a libertarian view of freedom, then it's very, very natural to see that the fundamental purpose for imprisonment is punishment. Because after all, this person was free to do this and free not to do it, and it was ultimately their choice. Maybe they weren't free at the moment, but they were free to sometime in the past to cultivate the virtues to get to the point where they would have been free. So they're still responsible because they didn't work on themselves to habituate not being criminal. Note carefully, though, that the other three that are utilitarian in nature are all most consistent with the compatibilist view, because none of them requires that the person who did the crime is actually responsible for it or needs to be punished because they had a choice in the matter. Rather, that's set aside, and the focus is on the fact that this act happened, and we want to rehabilitate this person, program them, as it were, so it won't happen again. Want to get them off the street so other people aren't hurt. And we want to send a message of deterrence. So now, you could be a compatibilist and hold these three. You could be a libertarian and hold these three. But it's pretty hard for a compatibilist to buy into the first of those, even though they do it, at least in theology, if the doctrine of hell. But they really have not come up with, in my view, a good explanation as to how that can be fair if the person had absolutely no control over what they did and no responsible action took place. I'll say one more thing. And so what that's done is that's caused the justice system and court system to emphasize, rather than punitive justice, therapeutic justice, so that the purpose of imprisonment is therapeutic for the offender. What gets lost in this is the person that was harmed by the crime. They want justice. In other words, they want this crime to be paid for in an appropriate way. Therapeutic justice hardly ever looks at the person that was the victim. Instead, they focus their attention on bringing a therapeutic help to the quote-unquote criminal.
Yeah, having taken some family law classes and spent some time in the state that I was in, they had a separate court actually for drug-related offenses. And it was almost entirely therapeutic justice is what they actually called it. And it was an entirely different system.
You bet.
They were different times. They were different judges. They were different responsibilities on the part of the lawyers. It's very, very different.
So this speaks to where underlying philosophies impact how we think about what the good is for society. And it's a whole conversation we could pursue in a lot of detail. Really interesting. I want to make another point, though, that is tied to it. And that is more the common sense understanding of justice, that often we naturally are crying out for justice. So there are cases in the media, a wrong has been committed, and we want there to actually be the person who chose to do this heinous crime, whatever it is, to be brought to justice. And that just assumes there's libertarian free will. We're assuming there's a person, and we might not know who it is yet, but there's somebody out there who made a choice that was a wrong choice that he could have or she could have not made, wasn't determined to make. But because he or she made that choice and led to these horrific consequences, we want justice. We want that person to have to be held accountable for the libertarian free will choice they made. And so it just seems deep in our understanding of what justice and what the legal system is all about in the first place. There's just this common sense notion that there's libertarian free will. Therefore, people have made wrong choices that they weren't determined to make. Therefore, they should be held accountable.
They're responsible.
They're responsible.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
Well, it seems to me that very often the work of the defense is to prove to what extent the person was not free to make that decision.
There you go. There you go. That's an excellent point. Excellent point. Because to that degree, they're not responsible.
That's right.
And this is just sort of, it's like David Hume said, I can't really know there's an external world out there. I can't trust my senses. But he admitted when he was at home playing backgammon, he left his skepticism aside, and he played games and ate his dinner and knew that the table was there and the game was there. And the same thing, if you hold to a compatibilist view of freedom, and I don't want people to get upset with this, this is just my observation, I actually think that in their day-to-day lives, they live as libertarians. Mm-hmm. Though they will immediately shift to compatibilism, if they're talking about their theology or whatever. By the way, if physicalism is true and we are simply entirely material objects, we're computers or brains or whatever, and that's it, then we are not libertarianly free. And so as physicalism has become the default position, what you said, Jordan, that there is a certain place for those people who couldn't control their actions to get therapeutic justice is going to just keep increasing as a result of a strictly physicalist view of the human person. Have you noticed that when some mass shooter goes into an elementary or high school and shoots 10 to 12 people, virtually the entire discussion is done in psychological and therapeutic language, not moral categories, and the person's at the end of the day chose to do something was wrong? No. The moral, I mean, everybody says it's outrageous, but we're trying to assess the person who did this. We don't say, you know, at the end of the day, whatever influenced him, this was a choice he made. He was free not to do it. And he did something that was just flat evil. And that's on him. No, we say, well, what was his childhood like? Was he a loner? And was he made fun of and bullied in school? Now, I think there's a place for that because that can help us get insight. But I don't think that those factors determine that a person does what they do, but I think they influence. So I'm not against that, but I am against it as the whole cloth issue. And there's no room for bringing moral categories in and saying that guy's an evil dude and what he did was flat wrong because he could have chosen not to do it.
There has been really interesting research following tragedies like the ones you described, JP, where if the media, especially the local media, focuses significantly on the shooter rather than the victims, there are significantly more copycat-like behaviors exhibited. So you think about that when we all know the name of the shooter, but nobody knows the name of the victim. So that is a place where we are looking and we're trying to explain, we're trying to solve a puzzle because we don't understand why anyone would do that because our theology of evil is just incomplete at best.
Absolutely. And Dallas Willard made a comment about all this when he noted that we are in fact fallen creatures. It's not only a biblical truth that you can take or leave, it's reality. I mean, everybody's fallen. So the question, well, how is it possible that somebody could do that is really the wrong question. The real question is, how is it possible that there aren't more people doing it? Because it's shocking that given our fallen nature and that we're all capable of an awful lot of stuff, that we're not all doing worse than we are. So I think that when Christians say, how is it possible they would do that? They're not thinking through the implications of how of the fall of the human being.
So let me broaden this or take it in a little different direction. Let's talk politics. We sort of have already. Here we go. But maybe in a different way than you're thinking. I think the entire project of the polis, of the political realm, and what it is and how we live in it well, is predicated upon a libertarian free will understanding of what we are and how we come to decisions. You just think about the role that historically, and I'm talking throughout the history of civilizations, save those that are not free states, you know, communist states, for instance.
And just to be clear, Stan, when you use the word liberal democracy, you're meaning it in the classic historical sense, namely a democracy where there is a free exchange of ideas instead of a secular progressive, leftist government.
A good distinction.
So I just want to make sure our listeners understood how you were using that.
Yeah, thanks. In liberal democracies, think about the role that debate plays. This idea that we can come together either in an actual public square, town square, or virtual town square of some sort, and listen to different viewpoints on a subject, a debate between different people or groups, and think through what they're saying such that we can make our own decision, right? It's a decision I make as a libertarian chooser. So the whole notion of civil discourse, discussion about ideas to conclude together what we ought to do, all of those things are predicated upon a fundamental understanding of me as an agent, and everybody as an agent who can make choices that are not determined by prior conditions, a libertarian notion of what we are.
You know, John Searle, a professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley, was not a libertarian. He was a certain kind of materialist, but he acknowledged that all of us think and act as though we have libertarian freedom. Mm-hmm. We're not determined, and we don't have compatibilist freedom. So when I go down to a restaurant and the waitress says, what would you like? I don't say, well, I'm going to have to wait to see what I ordered before I can answer that question, because I don't have a choice in the matter. You know, we choose. And you see, if you thought that what you were going to order was already determined before you picked up the menu, then you're not literally browsing the menu in order to make a decision. You're simply passively doing what you were determined to do, and the result is already fixed. That same point applies to deliberation. If I'm deliberating about which side of a debate I'm going to end up thinking is the more reasonable, if I actually thought that something had already determined what's going to happen before I even started deliberating, then the very act of deliberating would not be possible. I would not be deliberating in the sense of weighing different things and weighting them, maybe assigning more weight to that than this, all with the assumption that I have it made my mind up. And when I do, I will choose to go according to that, though I could have weakness of will and go with what's popular, even though I don't think it's rational, but mm-hmm. I'm sure probably going to choose such and such. And so I think the very act of deliberation assumes a libertarian notion of freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even using the word deliberation reminds me again of the legal context, the legal system we have that asks jurors to do the same thing. Deliberate, look at the evidence, understand the arguments, make the rational decision of guilt or innocence based on this, assuming you can choose without being determined. So it's just pervasive. And
it is.
You know, we're talking also about often voting your conscience. Well, what does that even mean if you're not a libertarian in your understanding of freedom?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this sense of you've got to make the right decision that you think is appropriate, even though it might be contrary to everybody else you know or the prevailing winds of the culture. You've got to vote your conscience. You've got to vote according to what you think is the right thing for the situation. And mm-hmm. this is easiest to see, I think, when we compare it to nations or that believe we are determined, have that as their underlying assumption. So there is this commitment to controlling people because they can be controlled. In other words, because people are not free but are determined by certain beliefs they have, then there are states that take this view, and I mean here nations, not U.S. states, but nations mm-hmm. that take this view that then give people the beliefs they should have. I'm thinking of Marxist states that have worked very hard to in their statecraft, develop a certain narrative that everyone needs to understand and believe. And because they think that if they understand and believe that to be true, it will determine everything else. And that's why they spend a lot of time and energy on reinforcing that narrative, that story. Now, of course, there's always dissenters, right? There's always these dissidents who, even though they have all the beliefs instilled in them from an early age through the state, they say, no, that's not right. And they dissent. They express libertarian free will. How do you make sense of that if you aren't a libertarian?
Mm-hmm.
Amen. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. And it's also really interesting when you're talking about the freedom of discussion or dialogue or the exchange of ideas, it's also implied there that someone could actually change their mind. Mm-hmm. So when you have a jury, for instance, when they're in deliberation and presenting those arguments, they're trying to convince you of something. Maybe a jury has a majority opinion and they're trying to convince the minority opinion of their correctness, depending on what kind of ratios they need to get a deliberation through. And when you put that into a bigger context, you look at those countries, and often, very often, those very determinist countries have a caste system because they believe mm-hmm. that not often a literal caste system, but sometimes a literal caste system, where there is an incredible resistance to the idea of change or social mobility in any mm-hmm. way, because people can't change their minds. They can't mm-hmm. change their circumstances. Mm-hmm. They can't change any of these things, because that would be to be confronted with evidence and decide something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, you bet. That's right.
Yeah. So several years ago, Peggy Noonan, who's a political commentator, said in a Wall Street Journal article that when she was teaching a class at a university, that the other day a student asked about the predictability of human response to a given set of political stimuli. I answered that nothing political is fully predictable, because you never know what a person will do, how a person will respond, what truth will be apprehended and reacted to. So, again, to this point of, there really isn't this fixed set of beliefs that will determine what someone will do. And even if the state says there is, the fact of the matter is we observe quite the opposite every day all around us.
And it's important, I think, Stan, to point out that what you just said is entirely consistent with being able to make predictions about huge numbers or populations of people mm-hmm. that are very generally and for the most part true. Right. For example, I mean, electrons don't have free will, okay? But let's assume that quantum indeterminacy is ontological. That is, at the subatomic level, things aren't determined. They simply spontaneously move one direction or another. Okay, you shoot an electron through a little slit, and you cannot predict where that electron is going to land. It could land anywhere. So the individual electrons are completely unpredictable in terms of what they'll do. But you can still predict probabilities as to, is this percentage likely that it'll land in this circle? And so the ability to predict the pattern of a whole number of electrons mm-hmm. in no way is inconsistent with right. the in principle unpredictability of individual ones. And the same goes for now those with free will. Just because you can't predict what a voter could do doesn't mean you couldn't make general predictions that are not airtight like a law of physics, but they're sure. probabilistically reasonable.
Right, right. Yeah. And at the macro level, it plays out in the social sciences as well, right? With sociology.
Yes.
Sociologists can know some tendencies, but because of libertarian free will, it is a probability. It is a general tendency. It is never the deterministic, well, it, with this stimuli, this will be necessarily and every time the result.
Yes, yes.
We will return to the show in just a moment, but first, a word from our sponsor. Do you have a child, relative, or friend preparing for or attending college? What they need most are Christian professors who can help them learn to love God with their hearts and minds during these impressionable years. Global Scholars equips Christian professors to be there for them and walk with them during their years in college. Please visit www.global-scholars.org to learn how you can help equip Christian professors to show Christ's love on a campus near you and around the world. Please also check out Stan's other podcast, College Faith. While this podcast is focused on the ideas prevalent in our culture, including our universities, the College Faith podcast is more focused on the practical issues of thriving in college as a Christian. students, as well as parents of students and soon-to-be students, will enjoy hearing from the guests Stan has on the show. Visit collegefaith.net or download episodes on your favorite podcast platform. And now, back to Thinking Christianly.
It may be interesting to go a little bit different direction for a minute, and let's just think about a cynical or critical theory in postmodern constructivism, the idea that there is no really a real objective real world, and even if there is, we have no access to it. So the idea that there's truth and that sort of thing is a bygone notion. Now, usually this is tied to what's called identity politics and group identity, which means that you do not have a self. There is no I or no self that could exercise freedom. Mm-hmm. Instead, your identity is the role that you play in your other identity group. If you're a lesbian, it would be other lesbians. But the point is that this is a kind of constructivist determinism, because we have to conceive of an individual human being as a mass of matter, let's say, with no self inside that is free to make individual choices, because there are no individuals apart from the organismic body that's moving around. All right, then what are we to make of their body movements and behavior? Well, that is determined by their identity group. And so, as one person put it, it would be very difficult to be a postmodern therapist, because the postmodern therapist is assuming that this person has an identity and can choose to resist and change that surface identity, because there's a deeper self that it goes beyond there being a lesbian or someone else. So I guess if you're a therapist and you hold to this deterministic view, maybe what you're doing is trying to add further deterministic factors that override the earlier deterministic factors, I guess. But then you'd be determined in the ones that you chose. And so there would be no way to tell if you're doing a good thing or a bad thing by doing that.
Well, and I think almost, I can't speak for all therapists, but I think that most assume that what they do when counseling clients are helping them make choices that are going to help them move forward beyond whatever the challenge is. Again, which seems to assume there's a freedom, there's a libertarian choice to be had, but that they have to choose. And that seems to be at least a central part of what counselors do, is help people get to the place of making those choices to improve their lives. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
You bet.
I think so.
Someone might give a counter argument to our claims here about, you know, determinism in therapy by making the following response. Well, look, I've been practicing as a therapist for 20 years, and I can't tell you how many people I've had come in that were addicted to one thing or another, and they were completely determined. They had no power over it. They had no choice. But mm-hmm. through therapy and work, we were able to reestablish their freedom so that they could say no to things. Mm-hmm. And so I've actually witnessed freedom, even though I'm a compatibilist. I've actually seen this. So my response is that this represents a misunderstanding of libertarian freedom, because for the libertarian, the area over which you have freedom can shrink or grow. Mm-hmm. And to make sense of that, I'm talking now about first order freedom, which we introduced a couple of sessions ago. First order freedom is the freedom to do something or refrain from doing something. Second order freedom is the freedom to cultivate the freedom to do something or say no to something. So there was a time when I could say no if I knew ice cream was in the refrigerator, And I could eat it or not eat it. And I really had the power to choose one way or the other. Well, there have been times in my life where I've lost that freedom. I've gotten to the point where I can't rest until the ice cream's all gone. I have to eat it all. And I can't, at least to my knowledge, I can't resist the urge. I feel determined. I feel out of control. But that means I've lost my first order freedom. So my first order freedoms has shrunk. Yeah, I used to have a freedom I no longer have, but I still have the freedom to develop the freedom to say no to ice cream. And I think that's what therapists do, is they want to figure out questions like, why are you addicted? What led to this? And how can we reestablish your freedom to say no to that? Well, that is consistent with being first order determined by an addiction, but still having the second order libertarian freedom to unhook from that through help and various other sources. So that would, I think that's the way I'd respond to that kind of a counter argument.
Mm-hmm. And you've also got the second order freedom to not pick up ice cream at the store and yes. not have your wife pick it up.
Yep.
And so on and so forth, such that at that level, you're making free choices.
Yes.
Even though you don't have the first order freedom, if it is in the fridge, not to go get it.
Yeah. A very good point. Just don't put it in the fridge.
I want to make the quick point that we are very pro-counseling on this podcast, and we have a few episodes
where
we talk about finding a therapist and finding someone to talk to. So we'll link those in the show notes in case you're just dropping in on this conversation. Just want to make sure you know that we think that's a really helpful tool that God has given us.
Yeah, good point.
Yes.
Hey, let me touch on another thing related, but not quite the same as counseling, but it's in the broader area of us in terms of our spiritual formation. And I think in that realm, there's an assumption that we all have a priori that we make libertarian free choices as well. This is what Dallas Willard and many others have talked about in terms of the spiritual disciplines. Again, these higher order choices one makes to practice in certain ways so that when the first order challenge is presented, we aren't determined to just do what we might have otherwise done that isn't the best, so that we've got this first order freedom eventually to make the right choice in this situation because we've practiced enough yes. and are able to therefore in the moment do what we ought to do. And so, yeah, this whole idea of understanding libertarian freedom and the hierarchy of capacities is so important.
Yes.
Again, not only in the counseling issues we've been talking about, but spiritual formation as well.
Well, in fact, Dallas defines a spiritual discipline as doing something you can do to get yourself in a position to do what you should do but can't do.
Mm. Mm. That's good.
Yeah, those spiritual disciplines can often be really challenging. I don't usually wake up in the morning and think, you know what I want to do? Fast. Developing that want to is really hard, but I can develop a want to.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that second order capacity. I want to be the kind of person who chooses to fast.
This is so important, Jordan, because this really does affect our honesty with God when we pray and talk to him rather than faking it. I mean, if someone's addicted to pornography or if they have an opportunity to witness to some person down at the end of the hallway in their dorm, they may say to God, you know, Lord, I really want to do this, but I'm afraid or I'm struggling. Whereas the fact of the matter is that's probably not true. They want to watch pornography and they do not want to go witness, but they want to not watch pornography, and they want to go down and share. And so you can say to the Lord, Lord, I don't want to do this. And that's the truth, but I want to do it. And I'm opening my heart to you honestly and sharing where I'm really at. And I'm asking you to work with me because I want to do this and help me get to where I actually want to do it at the first order level. Mm-hmm. And that helps you remove a lot of faking it mm-hmm. when you're talking to God and you're trying to fake it, you know, before him. Mm-hmm. It's very helpful, I think.
That's a great point. Mm. So I want to circle back to something we were talking about a minute ago. Historically, one of the arguments that we actually have a soul has been that we have these beliefs and these desires, and they inhere in something. There's a self that has these. I'm a soul that has a belief in X or a desire to do Y. And as contrary to an alternative view of the person that's known as a bundle theory of the person, where there are just these bundles of properties like beliefs and desires and whatnot, but they're not in anything. There's nothing that has them. And one of the problems with taking a compatibilist line is you lose that argument. And I think one of the strongest arguments that we are a soul, because we're aware of all of these properties, these beliefs and desires, and we seem to be aware that we have them, that they're ours. It's my belief, it's my desire, not just a bundle of beliefs that are just there together, but they're inhering in me as a person, as a self, as a soul. So if you go the route of compatibilism, there's no room for a soul. You can't make that argument. I mean, you can posit there's a soul, just say, hey, no, I'm just going to say this is the case. But you lose one of the good reasons to believe we actually are a soul, and are, I think, much the worse for that, because it doesn't then make sense of our lived experience of being the possessor of these beliefs and desires. And so that counts against a compatibilist view where you don't even need a self. You can have them just on their own.
Well, Stan, to illustrate your point, several years ago, I team taught a graduate seminar on free will, and I was a libertarian, and the other professor that taught it is a dear colleague who was a compatibilist. And, you know, during the course of the semester, it was a very friendly conversation, and we'd raise problems for each other, and the class would chime in.
I was in that class.
Oh, you were? Okay. Well, you remember
that.
That
was great.
Well,
absolutely.
Well, I asked the professor, as far as your theory of human action, the compatibilist theory, that is consistent with there being no self or no soul or no I. In fact, it's consistent with being just a series of events or a bundle mm-hmm. of events or properties at a particular time, like you said. And he said, you're absolutely right. I do believe in a soul, but that's for other philosophical reasons that have nothing to do with action theory. When it comes to my theory of compatibilist agency, there need be no self. But for the libertarian view, there does have to be a soul or a self who has the power to act or refrain. So he is not identical to the power and the bundle of powers itself, but he stands over and above them, and he can guide a set of action steps to finally reach his desired goal of getting to the grocery store. Anyway, I had a specific example of that, and you're spot on that.
Well, and this might be going into too deep of waters, I don't know, but let me just offer this. I still remember the term paper I wrote for that class. And what I discovered was we read a wide range of libertarians and compatibilists. And it seemed to me, and this is what I argued, that they came to their positions in large measure in relationship to where they started their questioning or the data they looked at. So I discovered that the libertarians, and I was on the fence going into this class, I was trying to figure out where I came down, but I discovered the libertarians started their assessment with questions about what the nature of the person is, and issues of the soul and issues of capacities and how they're related to different faculties of soul and those type of things, and therefore how free will and the capacity to choose might be in that matrix causally connected to other things like beliefs and desires and whatnot. I noticed that the compatibilists, I think to a person that I read and interacted with, in this case with the other professor, started their assessment with the data of phenomenology in the sense of they were starting with what am I aware of in my inner life? And they were aware of their beliefs and desires leading them to certain choices. In other words, they were aware of their first order reality. And they were noticing, as you were mentioning before about an addiction example, that they seemed to be determined to choose based on what they believe and desire about X or Y. But the point I made in the paper was that it's more reasonable to begin with the ontology of the person in this conversation, just because if you start with your direct awareness of your choosings, you're only accessing the first order reality. And that isn't all to the story. Back to the point of robust understanding of libertarian free will understands a hierarchy of capacities where I've got the choices mm-hmm. I'm making to be able to make the first order choices. So I think that's yes. really important to think about more as we contemplate these different views.
Well, this point you're making also expands to the question of abortion and euthanasia. I published a paper a while back in a journal called Faith and Philosophy, arguing against a Christian philosopher at Westmont College. And he argued that when you lost the ability to reason, that you were no longer in God's image. Now, that could be at the end of life when you get to a point where you can no longer reason, or after fertilization and fetal development, that capacity it is not present until after when you're outside the womb. And so since you're not in God's image, then abortion or active euthanasia is not really killing a person. It's just killing a living body. Among my responses was that he has an inadequate set of distinctions because a fertilized egg may not have the capacity for reason, but it has the capacity to develop the capacity for reason. And I said, if you're going to evaluate me and what I am on my first order capacities, those things come and go. I mean, I used to be able to read Greek. Mm-hmm. I can't anymore. Mm-hmm. But now I can do certain things that I have the capacity to regain that capacity to read Greek is the point. Mm-hmm. And I think that your distinction has a lot of work to do in other areas of reflection besides questions about freedom of the will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually that example you gave can be taken to extreme as a reductio ad absurdum argument in the sense of there's only one point in our entire life where we're most fully expressing our capacities. We're always growing and developing, and then we get some point that we start to lose abilities yeah. and capacities.
I can testify to that.
So I'll tell you what, there was this one moment I think I was fully human, and otherwise, yeah, not so much, mm-hmm. which of course is absurd. Speaks again to the mm-hmm. fact that no, we've got high order capacities, whether or not we're expressing them at any given time.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Mm-hmm. And that's definitely going to impact things like sociology and anthropology and the way that we look at other human beings. There's a really big difference between looking at an individual as if they have free will and looking at an individual as if they are determined. And mm-hmm. one of the biggest differences there is hope. You know, we can have hope about an individual person's life in libertarian free will in a way that I don't believe that a determinist can. And even if someone has made decisions that led them to a certain place, they're never irredeemable. And I think that is a resounding theme through scripture. And so it's something that we can carry and have, maybe it's not hope that person will turn out to be the most virtuous person we've ever known, but just even a little bit can do real wonders in helping us really see the image of God in every person.
Yes. Well, and if you're a Calvinistic determinist, the truth of the matter is we're not all redeemable. Some of us are impossibly. Yeah. It's impossible for us to be redeemed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have kids, they're either going to be redeemed or they can't be. And there's nothing you can really do about it except be a passive instrumental cause of some kind. But that's I agree with you. Hope is a big factor here.
Mm-hmm. Anything else before we go?
Good discussion.
Yeah, there's a lot more, but we're at the end of our time. So maybe we can pick up some of these themes down the road somewhere.
Sounds great.
Good to be with you.
Me too, JP.
Me too.
That brings us to the end of this edition of the Thinking Christianly podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation in the pursuit of faith seeking understanding. Be sure to check out today's show notes at www.thinkingchristianly.org/podcast, where you can find more information and the resources we discussed. Finally, please do visit our sponsor, Global Scholars. Until next time, this is Jordan Plank, encouraging you to think Christianly.